You're listening to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. The numbers tell much of the story. Pennsylvania has 280,000 people over the age of 64 living with dementia, but slightly more than 17,000 beds at long-term care facilities devoted to Alzheimer's or dementia. This at a time when it's estimated there will be many more afflicted with Alzheimer's as the population gets older. The state had a plan that hasn't been implemented. It's not just a Pennsylvania problem either. It's estimated there could be 13.8 million people 65 and older with Alzheimer's within the next 30 years. That compares with 5.8 million today. It's been described as a crisis of care, and it is the topic of today's Smart Talk. Joining us on the program is Clay Jacobs, Executive Director of the Alzheimer's Association Greater Pennsylvania Chapter, Adam Marles, President and CEO of Leading Edge PA, and Dr. Ina Kaplan with WellSpan Geriatrics. I want to thank all our guests for being with us today. Clay Jacobs, let me start with you. Those numbers that I just laid out, I mean, they paint a stark picture. But in human terms, how widespread is Alzheimer's or dementia today?
So thanks, first of all, for having this conversation and bringing us all together. And that is it. When we look at the numbers, they certainly paint the scope and scale of this impact. But as my fellow panelists and other folks know who've dealt with this disease, the emotional toll, the personal toll, the physical toll on families and caregivers is so significantly greater. This is a progressive neurodegenerative disease that is ultimately fatal without a way to cure or slow that progression. And so for each of those numbers you mentioned, it is families and communities, workplaces, faith communities, and others that are dealing with this and seeing their loved ones change. And that's the incredible toll on top of all the statistics. That's the toll we see in the people we care about who are around us every day.
Yeah, I've often thought this is not a topic that sheer numbers can explain, but it is something that affects so many people, so many families. It is a human story. It is not a number story. Dr. Kaplan, are you seeing more people living with dementia as the population is getting older?
Hi, good morning. Yes, and thank you for having me as well. My practice focuses just on geriatrics, so I see a lot of people. I do think that since my training 20 years ago, that the numbers are increasing. And, certainly I'm seeing a lot of very old people who are being diagnosed with dementia, which is sort of the, you know, that's kind of, you know, when it happens, you know, we, as for every decade, the numbers increase. And, you know, when I was doing my training, we were taught that around the age of 85, about 50% of the population would meet criteria for dementia. So, and that's what we're seeing. You know, Alzheimer's disease is, it's getting a little bit more complicated. I used to think that there was sort of one definition for Alzheimer's disease, and we try very hard to separate it from aging, from what is normal aging, or at least what we oftentimes don't use words like normal, but aging, but it is part of aging. And at 85, you know, people have a lot of symptoms that we call Alzheimer's disease. So I am seeing a lot of people because people are getting older and living longer.
You know, something that you just mentioned, and these terms aren't interchangeable often, although people often do that. The difference between Alzheimer's disease and dementia.
That is a very, very common question. And people, you know, I would say that is probably the most common question people ask at the visit because they're really trying to figure things out. They're trying to sort of like, what does this all mean? And I oftentimes to try to liken it to other conditions because people have a lot more general knowledge about heart disease, lung disease. So I tell them that this is, you know, sort of dementia is the big heading. It's like saying you have heart disease. And now we're trying to figure out exactly which kind so we can give you better information about what to expect.
Adam Marls, president and CEO of Leading Age PA, that represents nonprofit facilities across the state. Those numbers that I gave in the introduction probably raised some eyebrows. I know it certainly did for me when I saw those numbers. Why aren't more facilities prepared to care for, I don't think it's an overstatement to say, the overwhelming number of people living with dementia?
Morning, and thank you also for having me here this morning. I think I'd recharacterize that a little bit. We estimate that in any given nursing home setting, about 75% of all the people who live there have some form of cognitive impairment. They may not have a diagnosis, but they are dealing with some sort of cognitive related challenge. And so we train our staffs entirely to make sure that they can deal with those challenges and help people. But the challenge in terms of putting together more dedicated settings for this disease often comes down to funding. To really care for people the way that they need to be cared for later in the disease process, whether they're in the moderate stages or the later stages, is very intensive. And making sure that we are funded well enough to care for people adequately, that means we've got to have more staff, that means we've got to have more training, and that has been an ongoing challenge. But the need is undeniable.
And we're going to talk about all the things you just mentioned, but something that I did want to point out is that even though those statistics that I gave in the introduction are talking about facilities and beds that are dedicated for memory loss or dementia, that, as you pointed out, 75% of the residents that you have do have some cognitive problems. So that raises the question, what's the difference between residents living in a long-term care facility and one that living in one or a wing or a program that is designated for memory loss or dementia?
I think it depends is the answer. There are different philosophies on the best ways to help people who are living with dementia. Some people believe that a dedicated space that can provide specific types of engagement, specific types of programming are best. Others believe that segregating people in that way is not conducive to their ongoing quality of life, and that having them more involved with people who are not dealing with those memory loss issues at the same level have better lives. And so some of it comes down to philosophy and what is best. Other times it comes down to what a given nursing home or community can offer. Some don't have the space, some don't have the opportunity to put aside dedicated neighborhoods for these types of programs. But generally, all of the communities try to make sure that they have experts on staff or bring in expertise externally to make sure that people have the best quality of life possible as they deal with the progression.
Okay, so how does... Go ahead, doctor.
I wanted to add because it's, so dementia care units require sort of special admission requirements. So it really depends on the person. And the other piece of the information I wanted to add is that, a small percentage, so probably somewhere maybe around 20%, of people with dementia actually live in some sort of a care setting. Most of them are in the community. So this is not, this is sort of, kind of down the line when either you don't have caregiver support or you really need a lot of care. So it's not everybody who's living in these places, just a small number in comparison to mm-hmm. who is out there in the community.
Yeah, and we want to talk about both of the things that you just mentioned. But Adam, I want to go back to you for just a moment. Safety is something that has to be a big consideration, though, for those who are maybe in the later staged or more progressed in Alzheimer's because of maybe wandering away or going some places, even in the facility where they shouldn't be. Isn't safety a major issue?
Absolutely. It's a balancing act between providing as much independence for people to provide the best quality of life as possible and making sure that both within the regulatory scheme and just in terms of practicality that people have the safety that they require. So yes, wandering is definitely a concern. Falls are a concern. In some of the situations, depending on where somebody is in the disease process, there are concerns about wandering into other people's rooms and what that does from a privacy standpoint, et cetera. So there are lots of concerns in that respect that need to be addressed anytime that you're trying to care for these folks.
Clay Jacobs, as Dr. Kaplan pointed out, we're not just talking about people who are now living in long-term care facilities, but many, many more who are being cared for by a family member or someone coming into their home to take care of them as well. So as we are moving ahead in our conversation and talking about preparation, are families prepared for what's coming or maybe what's already here?
Yeah, so I would go to the latter of what's already here. We already know with 280,000 Pennsylvanians just diagnosed, that number expected to increase, never mind those who are not diagnosed, that it is already a significant issue that will increase significantly even in just the next 5 years. And what I would say is similar to all, families do the best they can, but this is still a disease and really all dementias that are fundamentally misunderstood. They are still ones that have stigma attached, that we may see symptoms, but don't talk about it, don't talk to our family, don't talk to our physician. By the time we do, then getting an accurate diagnosis, which is one of the areas we know continues to improve, to Dr. Kaplan's comments earlier. And we even expect in the coming years that that differential diagnosis may change the treatment path. And then as that progresses, do we know what to expect and what's to come and what the care planning options are? And so we've certainly seen things at policy levels trying to move that. But for families today, their journey with Alzheimer's disease, even while they're doing the best they can, is often reactive, right? Do we have services lined up before we need them? So then we reach that point, we have a plan. Does the person with a diagnosis have input onto that when they're able to? Even when we look at long-term care settings, have we talked about what that may look like? Do we end up in those situations because of a crisis of what we haven't planned for versus because it's the appropriate level care of the time? And so that is part of, you mentioned that crisis in care. That is the challenge with this, is that it really is a public health issue rather than solely an issue of aging and caregiving. It is from everything from public awareness through late stage care. And whether it's private or public entities, that means comprehensive, coordinated solutions, bring folks to the table like you have today, is part of what will get us there. And anything short of that will mean that we will still have gaps that families do the best they can, but not all of what they want to be able to do for their loved ones.
Let's go to Carol in Mannheim. Carol, you're on. No, okay, we're not ready to go to Carol yet. Sorry, Joe, I was looking at the wrong color. We have a color-coded scene, and Carol's not ready yet to go on the air, but hopefully we'll have Carol in just a few minutes. Clay Jacobs, something you said just before the break that I wanted to circle back on. You said there still is a stigma. And I wonder about that. What kind of stigma are you talking about?
So I think it's one of the things that I'm sure as Dr. Kaplan too would have input as she sees patients and families coming in. But fundamentally, this is a disease that impacts the brain. We know we can see through neuroimaging others, but yet how we view it as a general public is we either don't want to think about it, or when we do, it's a loss of the person we identify as, right? Whether it's memory or personality changes, whether it's things like loss of independence in some case. I mean, these things that the very definition of dementia is something that impacts daily life. So our ability to do the things that we've done throughout our lifetime have changed. Our ability to be that and have those interactions with our loved ones and peers, coworkers, change. And we see that, and yet that understanding of it as a neurodegenerative disease, there's still a gap there, right? And so we see those changes in daily interactions and who we are and what we identify, all of those types of things, and yet we don't talk about it. Even for ourselves, when we see symptoms, we know most folks don't actively seek a diagnosis. To Dr. Kaplan's comments earlier, is it normal aging? Is it something else? And so all of those things come into play. I think we're seeing a change in that. We see a change in popular culture, how it's represented. We're seeing a discussion of how we discuss, how we talk about it. We're seeing it as an issue of public health rather than solely as an issue of caregiving, and that image of mid and late stage individuals with Alzheimer's disease. So I think there's so much wrapped into that, but those are some of the things. And certainly, as I mentioned with her practice, I'm sure Dr. Kaplan has some perspective on that as well that I've missed.
If it's okay for me to,
sure.
to talk. Yeah. So, I'm really glad you said that, Clay, because there is a lot of, embarrassment and sort of, this idea that somehow, this is something that the person is doing on purpose or that they can somehow still fix. You know, we as kind of the medical establishment have always looked at the mind and body different. Like, we're not afraid to complain of shortness of breath or you're having a pain here, but emotional issues are always sort of something that is, kind of is presented until it gets to, not until it gets to a crisis, you know? And, you know, this is sort of reflected in all areas of medicine. You know, just the other day we were talking about billing. And if you put like a depression diagnosis as your first diagnosis of the visit, you don't get paid as much for the visit. So these are sort of these biases, this stigma is all around medicine. And medicine is just a reflection of our society. You know, so I think these are the kind of things that are important for people to understand. And I think part of this disease that also makes this, sort of difficult is that there's not much we can do to change the trajectory of the disease. We can change the quality of life and how people cope with it, but not at this point of how to fix it. So kind of people sort of say like, well, you know, doing something about it isn't really going to make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call from Carol. Carol's ready to go now. She's in Mannheim. Carol, you're on Smart Talk.
Hi. Thanks for talking about this today.
Welcome. What's on your mind?
Well, I've seen this disease twice with two different family members, and the last one was my father, and I was his care plan. I was his daily care. And what I wish would have happened, first of all, you can't stop it. And thankfully, I mean, right now the disease it's rampant, and all you can do is just deal with it as it overcomes your family member. And my dad had a wonderful end of life, and everything went well. Okay. However, it was so hard getting him there because he didn't have anybody listed for his doctor to talk to, right? And I knew something was wrong, but it took me like 11 months to be able to go to the doctor with my dad because he was suffering from dementia, and he didn't want me going to the doctor with him. So if we had more warning, like almost like a weather watch, weather warning system, you know, I could have planned better. I tell you what, it's very expensive. I chose to stop working full time so that my dad could die at home, right? Because I was his caregiver. Anyways, that's my whole comment.
Carol,
medical community could give us a warning if it's our immediate family member without violating all their rights.
Carol, thank you very much for your call, and sorry for your loss of your father. Dr. Kaplan, she brings up a couple points there. One of the challenges with Alzheimer's disease is there's no blood test. There's no test that you can send something to a lab and say, oh, yeah, he has Alzheimer's. I mean, a lot of your diagnosis goes by questions you ask the person, what family members or friends have observed and change in their behavior, things like that. Earlier, you mentioned criteria for Alzheimer's or dementia diagnosis. Now, this may be too wide-ranging a question, but what is that criteria?
So I wanted to kind of give you, you know, another piece of information that as part of, so Medicare has a visit that we call an annual wellness or well visit. And part of that visit is cognitive screening. So people over the age of 65 who have Medicare should be having cognitive screening every year. So that is one way of kind of getting to that. And then it's, you know, engaging family, making contacts, you know, those are, those will be part of the follow-up. The criteria for dementia is, you know, it's pretty, it's complicated and simple. You know, the simple thing is that it's basically a change from your baseline. This is not the way you used to be. And it has changed enough that you're no longer able to function independently. You need others to kind of get through the day. So that's kind of the simple definition. You know, this, you know, whatever is going on, it's your ability to figure things out. It's your ability to remember, to get things done is impaired enough that you cannot get things done on your own.
When does a person reach that point? And how do you know? Because so many people, whether it's the person living with dementia themselves or even their family members, because we were just talking about stigma, that say, well, okay, well, mom is older here and she's just having some memory issues. That's normal. So when is a decision made that someone should either get, you know, have someone coming into the home as a caregiver or that they should go to a long-term care facility?
So, Scott, I can start. I think there's one thing on the front end, and then first on the point of what Dr. Kaplan mentioned, that idea of regular cognitive screening to establish a baseline so we see what are deviations from the norm. We know this is it's a progressive, right? This is a continuum of disease rather than something that strikes like lightning one day. And so that acuity, when we see symptoms happening more often and more severely, it is somewhat subjective, but it is a pathway, right? It is a change of cognition. And so when we see those changes, whether it's, you know, we define them as warning signs. When you see two or three warning signs, those are the times to have the conversation, whether it's prompted by the Medicare wellness visit. I mean, there are a whole slew of things, but it is that more severe, more often, it's a change from the norm. That is the trigger, at least on the diagnostic point. And to a comment you made earlier, that is the now. Right now in research settings, whether it's lumbar punctures and spinal fluid, PET imaging, blood tests, we are not likely far away from a world where there are more consistent biomarkers to identify this disease earlier. And so while that is not the case today, how we diagnose in 5 years or 10 years may change significantly because of those advancements.
Well, that is good news. That is good news because, you know, that has been one of the real issues for people in denial. And I mean, my mother died of Alzheimer's when she first was diagnosed. You know, the test, one of the test questions she got was subtract 7 from 100 as far back as you can. And she did it perfectly. But, you know, and she used to tell people, they've diagnosed me with Alzheimer's, but can you subtract 7 from 100? She did it well, but it was obvious that there were some big changes there. Adam Morales, I want to talk about, you said that funding is one of the big issues for facilities that you represent. I also understand that we have a shortage of specialists. Is this something that in the long-term care setting, how often is there a doctor that comes in to see those that have been diagnosed? How often is there a specialist, or is that just up front?
So every nursing facility has a contracted medical director. Some of those are employed by the facility. Many of them are employed by a local hospital, and they come with regularity to work with everyone who lives in that community. Depending on the community and the doctor, that may happen more often or less often. And sometimes it's groups of doctors that come. but it depends. To your point, there is a need for more specialty. I think in the future, we're probably going to see, instead of just certified nursing assistants, we're probably going to see something like a certified dementia care assistant as we move forward, because the need is going to be so great. Currently, that paradigm doesn't exist in Pennsylvania. But I think, as Clay was saying earlier, if we work collectively on planning for this, we can create the future. It's a great career path then for someone who's passionate about caring for older adults, which is part of the greater workforce challenge that our field is going through. But I think just as importantly, or more importantly, then we've got people who really know how to help folks dealing with cognitive impairment as they decline, and can, again, make sure that their quality of life is as strong as possible.
Well, let's talk about some of those staffing challenges that you just referred to. The state is now proposing that each resident get 4.1 hours of care a day, compared to now it is currently 2.7 hours per day. Now, obviously, this is not measured, you know, at 2.7 hours. Someone doesn't say, oh, there's your 2.7, I'm gone. This is an average overall. There have been some in your industry that have said that's not doable right now, that we have a staffing shortage, especially during this pandemic, high turnover in staff. So what are your thoughts on what the state is proposing?
Sure. So just to be clear, the 2.7 hours per patient day is the current minimum. And if you walk into any quality community right now, they're not providing 2.7, they're providing something more than that. The reality is we have lots of members that typically provide more than the proposed minimum of 4.1. They provide 4.5 hours of nursing care per patient day. The reality in our time right now, prior to the pandemic, we're already seeing workforce challenges in our field. The pandemic exacerbated them. But we've got folks who typically staff at 4.3 or 4.5 hours who can't find enough staff to get to 3.3 or 3.4. In fact, we're seeing our members across the state closing nursing beds or closing whole nursing units because they can't staff them adequately. And so the real challenge with this proposal in this moment is that the realities of available people to provide the care, those people aren't there. And, you know, part of what we hear sometimes is, well, if you pay them more, then you shouldn't have any problem recruiting. There are two issues with that. Number one is, right now, we've got plenty of providers who do pay really well, $20 an hour, good benefits, et cetera, still can't find the people. Put that aside, though, the vast majority of folks living in nursing homes in Pennsylvania, that care is funded through the Medicaid program in Pennsylvania, the Medical Assistance Program. There has not been a rate increase for that program for nursing homes in 7 years. And as of 2 years ago, the average nursing home in Pennsylvania was losing $50 per person per day serving somebody relying on the medical assistance program. So providers are losing money caring for people and yet being asked to fund more somehow. And so someone's got to pay for that. And generally what that means is that people who are paying privately are paying even more for their care, and that's not fair to anybody. So the state really needs to step up and make a meaningful investment to make sure that older adults are getting the care and staffing that they deserve.
And there is a high turnover. I mean, this is, I've often said that it takes a special kind of person to work in long-term care facilities. It is not an easy job. The state.
No, these are.
Go ahead.
These are vocational jobs. These are people who care deeply about older adults. They are really hard jobs. This is a population of people who are helping others with their most intimate daily tasks. Right? It's eating. It's bathing. It's dressing. It's grooming. It's toileting. And you really have to be the kind of person who cares deeply about others to do that. And not everybody's comfortable in those situations. So we do. We need to honor those people. We need to respect the people who are providing that care. But we need the assistance from the state to make sure that we can pay them every dollar and then some that they're owed.
The state,
and Scott.
Go ahead.
If I can, I just think to that point, too, and I think to the base, too, it is encouraging that the Department of Health is looking at these regulations, right? That had been a piece as well. And so the staffing component to Adam's point, but part of that is setting a standard for staffing and quality of care. particularly with those related to dementia, there's also a nuance to the things we mentioned, right? Acuity of a unit or a location, how severe those, how far along they are in the disease, all of those type of nuanced conversations are an additional part of this, right? And at all care levels, at all care settings, because, you know, we talk often, right? If you know one person with dementia, you know one person with dementia, but that may mean the same number of people has significantly higher or lower care needs on a day-to-day basis. And so I know with our time, some of those are really important, but that does mean that the detail and nuance in all of this is incredibly important and is, in some cases, different site to site. And so how do we balance some of those things is a really important part of this conversation.
Yeah, I wanted to add to that, one of the scenarios that frequently arises is that a patient who lives in a personal care home on a dementia unit, so who runs out of funds to pay because those are privately funded enterprises. And whenever they run out of funds, the only place for them to go, unless the family can take care of them at home now, which seems highly unlikely since they were already living in this situation, is a nursing home. And nursing homes are a lot more expensive than personal care homes. There's lots of areas where money can be saved. We have a lot of regulations that also kind of promote acute care transfers from any personal care home or nursing home when there is a change in condition because of licensing regulations. And so, you know, I feel like I see a lot of wasteful care, you know, sort of not necessarily care, but medical costs. I shouldn't say care, and how things are done because of regulations. I don't know if that's something that you guys, you know, Adam and Clay, if that's something that you agree with. I see Adam.
Yeah, I'm nodding here. We are one of three states in the country that doesn't allow the Medicaid program to pay for assisted living. So we've been advocating for that change for many years, and it hasn't happened. We're hopeful that it may happen in the near future. But to Dr. Kaplan's point, it would be wonderful if people who don't need a higher level of care aren't forced to move there because they've run out of resources. That would save the system money, and it would provide people the opportunity to live in a less restrictive place, which is better for them. The other thing that I would just add to some of what Clay was talking about is the regulations that the Department of Health is proposing are specific to nurses. And providing excellent care, whether it's for someone with cognitive impairment or someone who doesn't have any dementia or Alzheimer's challenges, it's best if it's interdisciplinary. It includes activities professionals, it includes therapists, it includes social workers. And making sure that we've got that wraparound care is critical, particularly for people with dementia, where we can focus on being very person-centered, knowing their life story, knowing who they've been in their past, so that we can use that history that still is part of who they are to help make sure that their care is as strong as possible. And we've got whole programs built around learning the history of people. So there's opportunity to do better, but we've got to make sure the regulatory structure helps with that and doesn't hinder it.
Let's go to Mike in Hershey. Mike, you're on Smart Talk.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to make a statement more than anything. First, it took me several years of nagging to get my PCP to have me tested. Then the pandemic threw that off by at least a year and a half or more, and I was tested. In about 2 months, I was told I have the pathology of Alzheimer's in my brain. So there is some physical evidence that that's so. I do want to say that there's no way in Hades that we are prepared for the oncoming rush, so to speak, of all of us baby boomers. So there might be a crisis now, but it's going to double, quadruple down on the crisis. And by the way, as soon as I found out my diagnosis, I already had a will, but I added power of attorney and medical power of attorney to all my kids. So, but I'm in a position where I can live comfortably now on the money that I make in retirement. I just turned 65, but that money is not going to be adequate for me to have a decent place to stay.
Mike, at least you're thinking about it, and I'm curious, what was your reaction when you were diagnosed? What were you thinking?
Well, not to be fatalistic, but I feel that I'm a good man. I've done good work over the years. I've helped feed thousands upon thousands of people. So, you know, it is what it is. And I'm going to do my best to delay the progression of symptoms. And by the way, there was a new drug approved by the FDA recently, I believe within the last 6 months, and that would have been great news. However, a friend of mine who works with a national, actually a global medical panel, said that all members of the FDA advisory panel voted against it because it was not effective. But the FDA approved it for use anyway.
Yeah, that has been very controversial. Mike, you know, saying good luck doesn't seem to be enough, but I'm glad you called in and told your story, because it can help a lot of other people. What did you notice, Mike, in particular, that made you suspect that you needed to be tested?
Well, this has been going on for the last 4 or 5 years. For example, I would forget the names of my grandchildren, and my kids would get a little peeved at that. But I told them and then after a while, what I did was I started faking it by saying, oh, let me talk to the baby or let me talk to the older one. So I got around that somehow or another. So I've been successful at hiding it, so to speak, but at the same time, pushing for some diagnosis. And I finally got that. And by the way, I am going to get a second opinion for what it's going to be worth to me at the University of Pennsylvania's Penn Memory Center. Mm. But with care for me, the future is a big question mark. So I don't know how long this is going to take, how it's going to progress, and I don't think anyone knows that.
Mike, thank you very much for your call. Dr. Kaplan, you know, I'm almost sitting here listening to Mike's story. You don't know quite how to react. Because, you know, you're sad, you have compassion for someone has been diagnosed, but the points he brings up are so good, and the points that so many people, so many things and experiences that he have that so many people who are diagnosed go through.
Yeah, so I think It is a great case to kind of highlight. You know, he's obviously still doing very well and is able to function independently. And in reality, we really don't have a great degree of certainty to know exactly what he has. If this is something that's going to progress or if it's something that he's going to be able to manage. The only way we're going to be able to tell is by seeing what happens over time. I think that, we have some suggestions for him of how to live healthily. I don't know what his other risk factors are, but, you know, when I am seeing a person, and the Alzheimer's Association has done a great job with sort of having these healthy brain habits. You know, we have evidence, good evidence that, your brain is a part of your body and the cardiovascular system is, you know, the same system that feeds your brain, feeds your heart. And so if we try to take care of our cardiovascular system and also exercise our brain, which is a little bit different than from physical exercise, then we can delay, prevent, cognitive changes. The problem is that just like with any exercise program, it's hard to do and it's hard to make it a habit and it's hard to continue and maintain it. And when you're already starting, when you're having some issues, it's, you're not as good at doing sort of things that require dedication and a lot of kind of cognitive perseverance and input. So, starting it when you're already having issues makes things much more complicated. So I think it's certainly important to be aware I don't think that we have necessarily a roadmap for what will happen to the caller. I think we would have to sort of continue to see him and monitor and see what would what's happening. But I think it's important to plan. I think he's trying to plan it just like the same way you would plan for your retirement. I think it's important to do that. So I'm glad that he's doing it, but I would sort of, my approach to it would be not necessarily being so certain that I know exactly what will happen, 5 years from now. It'll be clearer, a year or two from now.
Well, I think one of the big points that Mike makes is that he says that we were in no way prepared for all this. Let's take another phone call from Daryl in York. Daryl, you're on Smart Talk.
Okay, good morning. My question is, when a patient or an elderly patient is diagnosed, either through the cognitive testing or other factors that the doctor realizes, when does the safety and care of the patient overrule all the HIPAA rights and patient rights that they have to sign off on to get somebody in the office with them? With my mother, I had a power of attorney health care, so I could be with her. I was her spokesperson and could talk for her or listen. But if a person they want to hide it, they don't want to, let the family know what's going on, can the doctor overrule that and say, you really need to have someone here, therefore they're going to overrule whatever patient rights or HIPAA rights are involved? That's my question.
Thank you. Dr. Kaplan, what about that?
Absolutely. I mean, it's, there's a lot of gray areas. And just like, in your regular life, you sort of have to use common sense. I think that, when I see a patient in the office who's coming in that I have concerns about care, what's going on at home, there's evidence of self-neglect, inappropriate medications, complaints that seem to not ever be resolved despite all the care that I'm suggesting or providing. These are red flags. And so I will call and, ask family or friends, whoever is listed as a contact, what they're observing, what they're seeing. I don't think that I am, I'm not necessarily telling them that something is going on, but I'm saying I'm having some concerns. Is there anything going on? We also have the support of the Area Agency on Aging in terms of doing community referrals and just going out to the home and seeing what's going on. It is not sort of something that you have an exact answer unless somebody really looks like they're, picked up by the police because they're wandering out of the house naked and, wandered into traffic. So that would be a clear-cut case, but a lot of the cases are less clear. But we gather information and we talk to families all the time.
But okay, and if I could ask for a quick answer here, Dr. Kaplan, because we're starting to run short on time, I think what Daryl is bringing up is, what if like a family member, a parent is hesitant and in denial and doesn't want to come along?
Well, the family members just call. I mean, they should just call the doctor. We do that all, you call and say, I'm really concerned about my mom. She's a patient of yours. Mm-hmm. This is what's going on at home. The families can tell us all that, they can call. What we're able to tell them without sort of knowing more is a little bit more limited. So if in the caller's case, he's the power of attorney, certainly that would not be an issue for us to discuss medical information, but the family members can just call and say, we have all these concerns, what's going on? And at that point, the doctor, the patients are really not too resistant if the doctor sort of says, I have some concerns, I'd really like for your son to come along. Mm-hmm. I think I've never really had an issue if the patient says no.
Let's take a phone call from Rollin in Hershey. Rollin, I have to tell you, we only have about 2 minutes left.
Very well. Thank you very much. My name is Rollin Wright, and I'm a geriatric physician at Penn State University. I'm also a dementia care specialist, and I work in the long-term care setting, taking care of people with dementia across the spectrum of the disease. My original comment was going to be about the high cost of dementia care and the fact that assisted living in the state of Pennsylvania, as was already mentioned, is largely paid out of pocket. So these wonderful assisted living dementia support programs are inaccessible to most people with dementia and their families. And so my other comment goes back to one of the previous callers about planning for the future. A lot of the problems with the crises that arise in dementia care are because of a delayed diagnosis. It doesn't become apparent until the middle stages of the disease, with behaviors that become challenging often to the family members. The physician, there is a special type of Medicare visit called the Cognitive Assessment and Care Planning Services visit, and that is something that I do on a regular basis. And that is about laying out how to approach and plan for the future with dementia care. And part of that visit is looking at strictly capacity and making an assessment of whether or not the person has capacity to provide their own care or to take care of themselves with this disease.
Hey, Roland, I have to interrupt you. So I'm glad you called in, though. You had some valuable information. Dr. Kaplan, we only have a minute left, less than a minute. Someone asked, is Alzheimer's dementia genetic? Can you give me just a yes, no?
Yes.
It is genetic.
I would say yes. And it's genetic just like all other conditions are genetic. We have predispositions, and these are modified by our environment. So, you know, there's some cases where the, you know, things happen earlier in life and are much more severe. And in many of the cases that we see, the disease is cumulative over time and, you know, progresses as you get very old.
Mm. Clay Jacobs, Executive Director of the Alzheimer's Association, Greater Pennsylvania Chapter, Adam Marles, President, CEO of Leading Age PA, and Dr. Ina Kaplan with WellSpan Geriatrics. Valuable information. Thank you very much for being with us today. I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.